Yep. Hey, so this is Mark Goldberg from UN Dispatch, talking to you live from the offices of the American Prospect magazine.
And this is Matthew Lee, speaking to you from innercitypress.com, speaking to you from within the United Nations.
And that's your spot right there. That's where you blog from.
That's my spot. Actually, I'm here now, but I can blog from anywhere. Where the laptop goes, I've filed
Amazing.
Stories from next to the Security Council inside the briefing room one time. That was sort of Ooh. Fun.
Well, first things first, Matthew, yep. Happy UN Day.
Thanks a lot.
Wednesday was UN Day,
yep.
And how did you celebrate?
No, well, I was here trying to cover things as closely as I could. I think that's the most,
okay.
to give it its props, you've got to look at it closely, you know?
Well, I tell you, I noticed there are a lot of Grinches out there. I noticed on Wednesday, for example, Ahmadinejad dismissed Security Council sanctions as worthless pieces of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly, Niall Gardner, who's the Margaret Thatcher Freedom Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, wrote a piece in Human Events Online deriding the champagne-quaffing, canapé-eating UN bureaucrats who are celebrating while millions of people around the world suffer at the hands of the UN.
Wow.
Now, I don't even know what canapé is.
Right,
I imagine
right.
it's tasty.
Canard
Have you seen
says
any?
Something with canard or petard. No, I know what a canapé is. I'll cop to that. And there are a lot of canapés swinging around here. They're actually quite good. We've had – no, there's always like – in the lobby of the UN, there's always mm-hmm. like art shows opening. Year of the potato, before we get down to brass tacks, there has also been the year of the potato was celebrated here. And on that evening in the lobby of the UN, the mission of Peru made available – round potatoes, cubed potatoes, potatoes with cheese sauce. It was a potato fest. And that, I don't know if there were any canapés. And then they also gave ceviche, so that was pretty good.
Well, that's
so there are a lot of, I don't think that's the problem with the UN, though, so personally,
I don't think
the free
so.
Lunch is not
if,
the problem. It's the
Well, yeah, and I wonder if these sort of underpaid or overpaid and underworked bureaucrats that Niall Gardner speaks about, I just wonder if he's met, a guy who's lost his limbs demining a schoolyard in Cambodia,
There are units of the UN where people work inordinately hard. In fact, the hardest working there are some people mistreated by the UN. The national staff in the Democratic Republic of the Congo recently went on a strike because they're paid $8 a day with no health benefits, et cetera. So these people, my hat's off to them. I am saying if you hang around here enough, you will see a number of people that you'll say, I'm not sure what they're doing all day. But that's probably true in any big bureaucracy, you know?
I would think so.
And a surprising, surprising critique of the UN that I saw only today was by Jose Ramos Horta, who's a big UN
of all people,
guy.
Yeah, he was sort of on the short list of perhaps being the Secretary General.
Which makes it so interesting that he's quoted.
Well, we should back up for our viewers and listeners. Jose Ramos Horta is the Nobel Prize winning president of East Timor.
Yep, which is obviously a country whose creation the UN played an enormous role.
Yeah, it's the first country of the 21st century.
Now there's a sort of Truth and Reconciliation Commission there that because it has the ability to grant amnesty for war crimes, the UN is saying that it will not participate in it, which I personally think is a good thing to be saying. But Ramos Horta wants the commission to do its work, and so was quoted as saying, the UN isn't just UN bureaucrats. The UN is countries like Indonesia and East Timor. So, in fact, the UN is participating. Screw the UN.
Yeah.
Literally, UN quote on UN Day itself.
Yeah, well, interestingly, that sort of tension between national reconciliation processes and human rights and war crimes trials is something that plays out in a lot of these peacekeeping missions.
Yep.
In Sierra Leone, for example, the original peace treaty that had inscribed in it that there would be sort of this Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and later on, when the true scope of the horrible war crimes were divulged, the Security Council felt like they needed to have actual judicial process underway, so they created the Special Tribunal for Sierra Leone,
mm-hmm.
Which, among other things, has Charles Taylor of Liberia on the dock right now.
Mm-hmm. No, he's the main. I've actually seen the prosecutor comes through the UN periodically to report to the Security Council, and also I've talked to him. He said he's mostly hat in hand because he has to raise the funds for his court.
Exactly. Well, that's the problem is that it's not funded through assessed dues. Right. It's funded through voluntary contributions. And the former prosecutor was a U.S. Defense Department guy called David Crane, who's now, I believe, a law professor in Syracuse.
Right.
Who's the new guy?
Now you have a strapping guy called Rapp, and he comes from the Midwest. And
okay.
The most interesting
– Another American?
He is. And
okay,
the
so that helps with fundraising, I imagine.
He helps with fundraising, and he also has his own. They're paying an outside PR firm, Hill and Knowlton, to do his PR for him. So it's very, from what I've heard.
I tell you, you know, if it pays.
I agree.
You might as well. It's hard to raise money for these.
Right,
things.
Right. No, it was just sort of interesting. It was sort of like whether in house there wasn't. I mean, there's an enormous UN PR machinery. I was going to call it a bureaucracy, but I'll call it a machinery.
Yeah.
It seemed like an implicit critique of it to go outside, but if it works. You know?
Yeah, you know, albeit that's a problem, you know, with voluntary contributions is that, you know, it only works so long as people's attention are focused on the crisis.
Right.
You know, I imagine the late 1990s when the true, you know, devastation that was wrought upon Sierra Leone was coming to light, and you know, you had a lot of developed countries willing to pony up, but now it's they still have a lot of work to do.
They sure
but
do.
There's not enough, you know, money to fund them.
Right, right.
Which is, you know, a problem with the voluntary contribution theory of funding international institutions as a whole.
So I've thought of a way to get us into Darfur, which may
bring
be a major
back.
Topic
yes.
of the day. And we'll
do
it's
tell.
Actually maybe it's a rather than jumping straight to these peace talks in Libya, I'll tell you that
we'll get there,
that a little piece of Hollywood came into the UN within the last week. I forget exactly which day. There's a new there's a film. So we'll start it. We'll do Darfur as film review. There's a film called Darfur Now, which you may or may not have heard of, but it came.
I have not.
It was shown at the UN. It has a lot of Don Cheadle in it. It has a little bit of George Clooney in it.
Yes, I know. It's the film by the Enough Campaign, which is a at least in D.C. the Enough Campaign was sponsoring.
Sure.
They
may have sponsored. No, this guy's a major. Big director, and
surprisingly,
he was given access to Darfur by the government of Sudan, and it's beautifully filmed. I mean, it's not a handheld. It's extremely. It makes things extremely simple. I mean, it's basically they choose a rebel who says, you know, all we want is to get back to our land. Al-Bashir must die. So they screened it here, and then there was a panel discussion with various UN, you know, pretty high-level people in peacekeeping, political affairs.
Yeah.
And I think I hope this is the right way to get into it. But the reality was is that the UN people ended up saying things are a bit more nuanced than the film has presented it. Meaning, like, for example, in the most recent incident where African Union peacekeepers were shot up, it's pretty clear it was the rebels that did it. You know, nobody, I think, thinks all the rebels are good, but there's a conflict there. You have a government, and you have armed rebels, and you have clearly the government is the instigator of the vast majority of the force. But they've started to be, you know, kill. I mean, when peacekeepers are killed by rebels, it has to be said. So I guess this is the reason I thought of this as getting into it is the director, upon listening for about half an hour to the UN experts sort of say just how complicated everything was, said, you know, suddenly stood up and was like, there's a possibility and a danger of like paralysis by complexity. And he said, you sort of have to,
true.
Which I think is a lot. I mean, I'd put it this way. I think in our previous. We've talked a lot about a critique of the UN that comes from the right wing that says the UN's a waste, the UN has no money. I think there's a critique, and I hear it, and I'm sure you hear it, there's a critique from the left of people saying the UN, or maybe it's from the right as well, sort of, ha-ha, you didn't stop genocide. But I think there's well-meaning people that would say, I mean, and I don't mean it's just because they're well-meaning they're on the left. I mean, there's a critique of the UN that says you're not stopping genocide. And I'm not sure those are the same people that say the UN is wasting money.
No, I don't think so. But you know, I think few people think that. You know, I think me coming from the left as a, you know, UN supporter, of course, you know, we think that there are many ways in which the UN can be improved. But to blame the UN for the genocide in Darfur ultimately distracts sort of international attention from the places where pressure ought to be applied to bring a stop to the genocide in Darfur. For example. There's peace talks in Libya next week, and you have from the UN Jan Eliasson, who's trying to convene these peace talks, and he's trying to get so far. Most of the rebel groups of significant numbers are not participating in the peace talks, and you know this is much to Jan Eliasson's chagrin because he's doing the most he can and all he can to try to get these people to the table, but Jan Eliasson can't sort of wield a threat of sanction to bring these people to the table. He depends on member states to apply that kind of pressure. The UN itself doesn't have sort of intrinsic ability to force people's hand.
Right.
What they have is an ability to bring people together. What they have is perhaps some back channels.
Right.
But Jan Eliasson himself, the Secretary General's Darfur guy,
mm-hmm.
cannot sort of twist the government of Sudan's arm, and he cannot twist the rebels' arm. He needs to depend on states like China that have strong bilateral ties
yep.
with Khartoum to step up, or Libya, which has some ties with the rebel groups, to step up.
Mm-hmm.
They depend on the support of member states. And, I think in the five long years that the Darfur crisis has been unfolding, what we've seen is a consistent lack of political will on the part of key member states like the United States and China and many European Union countries to do all they can to stop it. It's not just high on the list of priorities.
Sure. No, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I guess what I had sort of aired, and I think when people sometimes say the UN, they're also talking about the Security Council. I mean, I think there are people that look mm-hmm. at the Security Council and say, how can it be that
yeah.
they've, that sanctions have not been brought, that there hasn't been that. I guess you can say this. Who is it that decided that only with the full agreement on every point of the agreement of the government of Sudan could the peacekeepers
yeah.
go in? Such that, even now, daily
yeah.
questions are raised about they thought they had the agreement to get the hybrid force in.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll get in
yeah.
by the end of the year, maybe it won't. But there are still now disputes about whether any, not just Western, but even like troops, peacekeepers from Nepal, are they allowed?
Yeah.
There's a problem of getting helicopters.
We should back up for a second and say that what you're referring to is the government of Sudan has refused to let non-African troops participate
mm-hmm.
in the United Nations, the proposed peacekeeping force for Darfur.
Mm-hmm. And the UN is agreed. But again, let's be honest, it's not,
yeah.
they've taken that position, and the UN, for a variety of reasons, maybe based on its own charter of it's a club of member states, has said, okay, they've agreed to that, and then each time it keeps getting dragged down the road further. Clearly, the obstructions are being raised by the government of Sudan, but I think that
yes.
there's a critique that says enough already. Do you know what I mean? Now the question.
Right. I subscribe to that critique, and I think the Security Council ought to stop letting, Sudan rub their face in the mud and start, ratcheting up the pressure until Khartoum removes these bureaucratic obstacles that are, slowing the deployment of these peacekeepers.
Mm-hmm. No, totally.
Furthermore, you referred briefly to the 24 helicopters.
Yep.
The deployment, the African Union head of the peacekeeping force, because it's a hybrid AU-UN force, has a lot of pledges from small troop contributing countries. What he doesn't have is 24 helicopters to transport these troops to and from various places across Darfur.
Mm-hmm.
So, for lack of 24 helicopters right now, this peacekeeping mission is stalled. And, what we depend on, what the UN depends on, I should say, is donor countries to give them or lease them at least
mm-hmm.
these helicopters, but no one's stepping forward, not the U.S., not Europe, no one right now.
Just so you know, I think
two dozen helicopters. Yeah.
What the Western countries say is, and this is their, whether it's an excuse or it's the real reason, Sudan has also raised the issue that they'll take the countries that have this equipment are in general these Western countries, but the
yes.
Sudan is not going to accept pilots from those countries. So it's essentially they would be in the role of being equipment contributing countries, where they would give the helicopters,
yeah.
but to be flown by others. And somebody
said,
nobody's going to do that. But
why should this? And I think the reason that the Security Council is not sort of forcing Sudan to accept this is because, frankly, it's not a big deal in the domestic political agenda here in the United States. It's not a top priority for President Bush. He's not going to make it a top issue with the president of China or Putin. It's not a big enough deal.
You know what, Mark, I'm
going
to it's not to disagree with you, but I would say I'm
okay.
not. You can only guess at my politics, but I would say
yeah.
I'm surprised in the sense that it's interesting. A lot of people, I think, let's say what the Bush administration is saying about Burma/Myanmar. I mean, I think
yes.
that there are people that I perceive to be on the left that in fact criticize President Bush for being too strident in some cases. And maybe in every case it's just a pretext for some other thing. Maybe he's talking about Iran, about human
yeah.
rights in Burma in order to get business interests. But I think
right.
it's interesting that I mean, for example, they sent Andrew Natsios here. They have
yes.
Condoleezza Rice, inveighing. I mean, I'm saying it's just kind of objectively, certainly if you come out of the Darfur Now film saying there is a consensus in the United States that there can be no genocide there. You've got Arnold Schwarzenegger on camera signing away. You've got – so I'm not – I mean, I don't mean to be overly simplistic.
Well, listen, they say the right things. And they, you know, at the opportune moments, they'll give you know, like President Bush will give a speech at the Holocaust Museum with Elie Wiesel in the background announcing strong sanctions. But, you know, when you peel back the layer of the onion, so to speak, you know, there's not much there, and there's not much strength behind these sort of bilateral efforts.
Let me ask, I mean, just, and we can return to Darfur throughout this discussion, but do you think the Bush administration is too, from your perspective, is the Bush administration being arrogant and too strident about Myanmar, or not taking it seriously enough, the clubbing of monks in the street by a military government in
In what respects do you think they've been strident?
I guess they've had Laura Bush call. I think they've announced unilateral sanctions on military leaders, which the UN hasn't gone along with. I mean, I think the Bush administration would say on some of these issues they are more committed to, you know, ending dictatorships than the UN is. That's what they'd say. And I think
I haven't followed the Burma issue as closely as I followed the Darfur issue, but you know, it's certainly nice to see that they're saying the right things.
Hey, I mean, President Clinton shot missiles at Khartoum, didn't he?
What, I'm sorry?
President Clinton shot missiles at Khartoum, remember?
He did, yes.
So, I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to jump. I think that there's a series of critiques of both the UN and of the U.S. foreign policy. But I know that one of the critiques is that it's this arrogant sort of, you know, we're the United States, we bring freedom everywhere. Recently, you know, this week, Cuba, he's going to create a fund, and they won't recognize the brother of Fidel Castro. So I think that there's some people that say, not that the Bush administration is too committed to human rights, but they're just, they're very self-righteous. But then again, then how does this relate to the Darfur issue, I guess, is what this makes me think, is when you said that they're not committed enough.
Okay, well, here's something. So President Bush, to his credit, was in 2002-2003, was deeply committed to achieving a peace settlement between the North and South in Sudan, which was a devastating 20-year-long civil war that killed 2 million people. Yep. He appointed Senator Jack Danforth to spearhead this operation, and over, you know, many years of long diplomacy, they finally reached an agreement. Now, as they're reaching this agreement between the North and the South, the North, Khartoum, decided to launch their, you know, genocidal campaign in Darfur. Mm-hmm. Now, not wanting to disrupt that separate peace process, the U.S. government was reluctant to pressure Khartoum too hard. Right. To relent on their genocidal campaign to the West. But, and now the thinking at the time was, you know, when we have peace between the North and the South is going to join the government in Khartoum and become a government of national unity, at which point there'll be a moderating influence over the totality of Khartoum's decision-making in Darfur. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like a self-justifying fantasy to pursue this peace at the expense of Darfur. Now, sort of, you know, fast forward till sort of last month, we had saw the collapse of that peace agreement, where the government of the national unity collapsed, and the southern leaders retreated and are no longer, you know, a part of the government in Khartoum. Mm-hmm. And Khartoum, meanwhile, remains as intransigent as ever.
But you seem to be—I mean, I'm sorry to—so you're not saying that the Bush administration doesn't care about Sudan or Africa. You're saying that they're only...
No, I think they care.
They cared
I
about
think
one,
they don't
one
care.
Regional, one part of the Sudanese conflict more than the other? Or they're
Well, at that time they did. Right. I think it's different now.
Right.
I think they care. I think, you know, the president says he cares. The activists who I speak to him say, you know, he cares.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they don't care enough to make it a priority, say, above other competing issues at the Security Council, like Iran or like North Korea.
Right.
You know, it's understandable.
Right.
But, you know, I think, you know, we ought to point out that, you know, they care to a certain extent, not to the extent that they want to go toe-to-toe with China over this, because we have other competing interests.
Totally. I'm compelled to say this. If you have a conflict that's killing many people that nobody cares about apparently at all is Somalia. at all. In the sense that just being here on Sudan, you'll see Ambassador Khalilzad come out and say, we are these talks. I mean, they're boned up on it. They can talk about which groups are going. Yeah. They can talk about the intricacies of the al-Bashir's government's thing on Somalia, where basically you've had a government that's been supported by the UN and the United States that was put into power by Ethiopian troops armed by the United States, has now taken to saying that anyone that opposes it is a terrorist, including the women and children that are related by clan to these people, and has blocked humanitarian aid. There, nobody says anything about it here.
Yeah.
And so I think, I guess I'm saying, it's almost, this is something where both, even the UN itself said, let's cast our lot with this transitional federal government. The U.S. is behind it, and it's turned into a pretty stark example of, I mean, it's not just that they kill civilians, it's that they say openly, we are going to kill civilians.
Yeah.
And then do it. Yeah. And I think it's because the people that they're killing are perceived to be fundamentalist Muslims.
Well, right. I mean, it's part of our grand strategy. You know, there are plaudits and hosannas when the U.S. had this, you know, when we launched our little bombing campaign, so when we supported Ethiopian troops overthrowing the Islamic Courts movement. And, I think American policy vis-a-vis Somalia is dominated by sort of our war on terrorist interests. Mm-hmm. Which are, you know, more short term, I think.
But in this case, the U.N.
long term interest of building up Somalia as a stable country.
In this case, the U.N. itself has something of a foreign policy in the sense that the head guy was here. I'm thinking of this because the U.N.'s main humanitarian coordinator for Somalia came through earlier this week. Eric LaRoche is his name, and he's a good U.N. employee. He's been into a lot of places, but he said earlier this year he came to the U.N. headquarters and said, we in the U.N. system have to just cast our lot with this transitional federal government. It's the only chance to end the chaos. And he said, and this is what I'm encouraging us to do, and if I'm wrong, judge me later. And so now that he came back after not only – I mean, on a U.N. front, this same government then burst into the World Food Program's compound and took the head local guy, you know, imprisoned him. And what's behind that, although the U.N. doesn't want to say it, is – the government that the UN supported now says if you distribute food through mosques, you are assisting terrorism.
Huh.
And so it's essentially, and I think here's, I guess, where I'd say a difference. There are countries on earth, like in the case of the al-Bashir government, the UN, the secretariat, doesn't have a lot of leverage. So people look to China and say, China, you do a lot of business with Khartoum. If you don't tell them to clean up their act, you're to blame. But in Somalia, the UN, in fact, has had a lot of leverage with this government. If the UN hadn't given it all the trappings of legitimacy, if UNDP hadn't trained its police force, which now locks up WFP people, it wouldn't have all this. So again, I'm not saying the UN had like all this money, but where the UN, I guess I look on it this way, where the UN has leverage, in the same way that they had it in East Timor, right, which is a country that they helped form, in the same way they have it currently in Kosovo, they're actually running it. The test case to me, not as in a way like these are places where the UN Secretariat can't sort of blame member states. Like this is your laboratory of implementing all these ideals that you articulate, and certainly in the case of Somalia, it's not a very good testing ground, and it's a very tough ground. I mean, nobody.
Well, I mean, Somalia hasn't had a functioning government since 1991.
Right.
You know,
But then the answer to that isn't to say, as Mr. LaRoche did, government at any cost. We'll support these guys no matter what, because as soon as he said that is when they started going off.
So what's your solution? Do you have?
There's no genie in the bottle. But the UN, I think it was a mistake in that context to so blatantly choose sides, you know? I mean, there are...
Yeah, well, I think to the extent that, you know, member states can put pressure on other member states to, you know, promote, peace and justice in Somalia, the United States are a great ally as Ethiopia in the region. And, you know, there's a whole lot more we could be doing to have Ethiopia be a bit more of a positive actor and influence in the region.
But I mean, I think one of the problems that the Somalia case shows is that the willingness of both, certainly the U.S., but even like most of the U.N. to sort of look the other way when the people being killed are perceived to be kind of like radical Muslims.
Yeah.
It just plays into a theory, which is that not only is the U.S. Taking over the Middle East, but even the U.N. doesn't give a damn, or is too controlled by the U.S. right? There's a perception in many places. In fact, Alvaro de Soto, I don't want to go through all this. Even some longtime UN experts have said that the UN, in a way, is in some cases, contrary to what a lot of people in the United States think, that the UN is this, you know, hotbed of anti-Americanism, that in fact, in its actual important work in the world, is largely a tool of the U.S. And the Somalia case tends to show that. And we're going to full circle back to Darfur. One thing that took place in the last, 2 weeks, so since the last time we spoke, was in implementing this peacekeeping, hybrid peacekeeping force in Darfur, there's a need to let out a big contract. There's a need to build camps and bases for the troops. Most people had thought, okay, this is the UN. If you're going to spend a lot of money, you're going to take bids. You're going to look at the lowest qualified bidder and give the contract. Very quietly at the beginning of October, the Secretary General put out a letter. And they didn't announce it. They just put it out in what they call the racks here, that he had informed the General Assembly that because of the importance of the Darfur mission, regularly applicable rules of procurement and employment would not apply. No one really thought much about it. Somebody gave it to me and said, look at this. Something's going to happen. And what happened was...
Wait, can I interrupt you?
You can, please.
Real brief. Now, was his ability to do this based on sort of the reform agenda that went through in 2005 that granted the Secretary General a lot more of this kind of authority?
It wasn't portrayed in the context of reform. It was said there's an ability to override. In fact, I think it's actually contrary to the reforms, because most of those reforms have been about making the UN more transparent, more competitive, having stricter procurement rules to avoid corruption scandals, etc. Okay. This is something where it's a sort of a, I guess you can say it's a kind of an implied power in emergencies, which nobody disputes. If the building's on fire, you're not going to take bids.
Yeah.
But in this case, it was eminently foreseeable that the UN was trying to get a peacekeeping force into Darfur. But what I was building up to. Very quietly at a noon briefing, they announced, we've entered a $250 million contract with Pacific Architects and Engineers. So you hear that, you say, well, that's a lot of money. Who are they? Do a little research. It's owned by Lockheed Martin, the U.S.-based military contractor.
Yeah.
And the first day, I'm going to start, this is probably not the right way to tell the story, but so then the spokesperson is asked, was this done on a competitive basis? And the spokesperson says, oh, of course. They run in and hand her a note. She says, no, it was done on a sole source, no bid basis.
Okay.
A little more research. You say, okay, is the contract going to be made public? You know, what it involves, what you're paying for. Since there were no other bidders, it seems important to know what's being paid for in the contract. They say, yes, we're going to make it available. Then, the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon did a stakeout. I managed to ask him about it. He said, we're going to be totally transparent. The next day they announced the contract is not going to be made public.
Do you mean made public to the press?
Yeah, made public.
Presumably it's made public to member states, should they ask?
I'm not sure. In fact, because this is the thing that's amazing about it, is that this power to override the rules was done in the form of a fiat. He wrote a letter to the president of the GA saying, I can do these things and henceforth will. There's actually now started to be some rumblings among member states saying, why didn't they at least have a chance to sign off on that? And in fact, I just yesterday got a memo that initially the secretariat thought that they needed and were going to seek GA approval for the concept of overriding the rules. The question here becomes, I think the most benign explanation I can put on it is not that there's some, venal corruption, that Lockheed Martin, paid somebody money to get $250 million. The problem with it, though, is that, again, this is why I thought of to do it now in terms of talking about Somalia. The perception that – I think it's an interesting issue, because there's a perception that, like, the UN is very anti-U.S. and it's wasting – in this case, the U.S., which normally would be the kind of the voice for saying, we want more transparency, clean up the U.N., they're not saying anything about this. This was a no-bid contract in circumstances where it was foreseeable that they would have to do the work. In fact, subsequent events have shown that they could have done something called expression of interest, asked a number of contractors to say, we're interested in that contract, here are our capabilities. But for whatever reason, and there are people that say this, in fact, is a kind of – there are people that say this – that this is a payback, either a payback to the U.S. or a way to sort of like buy the U.S. in, because there's not going to be any criticism of this contract from at least the Bush administration. And ironically, even from people that normally would be suspect of kind of military contractors getting no-bid deals, there's such an interest in having peacekeepers in Darfur that you're not really going to have much criticism from that. If it was Halliburton, maybe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and also, you know, presumably, if the United States or other members of the Security Council wanted to, they could ask the Secretary General to give them, you know, the details of the contract.
That's one of the things I'm sure if the U.S. From by all accounts, if the U.S. wanted to call Ban Ki-moon up, he'd fax the thing through. That's what they say. The allegation is that the whole thing was negotiated down in D.C. and was all by basically American highly placed staff at the U.N. and Lockheed Martin and half of this company's business to date has been with the State Department, so it's an in-house game. But the
so,
the,
I guess I'm trying to go ahead. To th- you know the, yeah. To the extent that, as you said, this is an emergency situation. You know, as you said, it seems to me that like you know there's a reasonable reason.
But here's the thing: I'll give you an example.
I'm just trying to think why is this sort of driving you nuts up there?
I guess with all the talk, because. This shows you how arbitrary the thing is.
Okay.
A document emerged that the Secretariat has gone to the Budgetary Committee here and has said, okay, it was no bid, but we knocked down the price from $700 million to $250 million. And then when the document emerged, some people started laughing because they said, I don't know. How credible, what kind of a company pads its bid by a power of almost 200%? Right? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that the reason that there are procurement rules, and there's huge, in the UN, there's a procurement task force, there's a variety, most of the UN corruption scandals have been about procurement gone wrong. And so to have the largest contract that they've reached be done not only on a non-competitive basis, where you also don't disclose what's in the contract, how the price was arrived at. It's not, it seems contrary to everything that they've said about having the UN be transparent and go ahead.
I guess then, do you dispute the notion that the Secretary General ought to have power to grant these contracts in emergency conditions, such as what we're seeing in Darfur?
So
presumably the contract is to do things like build bases, like drill water bores,
those are all eminently great things. The only thing I'll say is all the way back to Kofi Annan, people were talking about the need to do them there. The word hybrid force and the desired size of it have been spoken about for nearly a year. It's not like the idea only arose in the middle of the summer, right?
Well, I think but it wasn't until last August until the Security Council actually approved a force.
End of July, absolutely. But check this out: since the questions has arisen, they've now put on the UN's website a solicitation of expressions of interest from contractors for a Somalia peacekeeping force, which hasn't been approved by the Security Council, which may or may not ever take place. It's a much more.
So does this mean that they're listening to you, Matthew?
That's not the point. I think the point is
you've got results.
No, they could easily have done it here. I mean, I think the worst is it's not that like ooh they didn't think of it. It's that this particular contract to this company with its home country at this time was perceived as something that they wanted to do.
Okay.
And so you're right to sort of chide it where like I mean I've had people here say to me like well why isn't like I mean let's go, we'll step back to go to like the usual suspects that criticize the UN. I think what's interesting is that. Like somebody said to me, why doesn't the Wall Street Journal cover that? And maybe they don't. Maybe because there's nothing wrong with it. I think that's what you're saying. My analysis of it would be most of the critique that they bring of the UN is of Kim Jong Il taking the money.
Right.
Right. If it's the U.S. taking the money, they're not going to say anything about it. Right. I mean, I don't know. And I think
I think it probably speaks to sort of outcomes. Like, what outcome can we expect from a Lockheed Martin contract in Darfur? Presuming the peacekeeping force does get off the ground, which is a big presumption.
Sure.
It seems that we would need a contractor.
Oh, definitely. Nobody disputes that.
We need like a reliable one, not one that sort of Kim Jong Il is recommending.
Oh, sure. No, but I think obviously there's a whole. I mean, look, there's a French engineering company that built all the palaces for the Turkmenbashi in Turkmenistan. There's and runs water systems all over the world. There are a lot of there are certainly the UN. In fact, the UN's capital master plan is going to be done by a Nordic company called Skanska.
Right.
So
yes,
right. It's not there. The U.S. doesn't have a monopoly on getting things done. But it's. I guess I'm saying it's not that it's driven me crazy, although you may think that it has.
I don't know. You're pounding away. I could hear the keyboard.
Yeah, because it's because in a,
flying. Yeah.
No, because the one. I mean, I think also in terms of how the current administration of the UN works. If you're going to do this, have it together. No, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's. They owe it to their own credibility to be able to answer questions about was it competitive or not? Are you going to disclose it or not? Do you know what I mean? It really, I have to say that it came, even publications that have yet to write about it said it looked amateur, you know? Because it's an obvious question, you know? And another thing that looks amateur, I'd be on an entirely different front, but to cover what's happened at the UN since we last spoke. Did you see the Washington Post articles about Ban Ki-moon, one, hiring his son-in-law becoming the chief of staff in Iraq, and then a much longer article last weekend about the number of highly placed South Koreans in the secretariat?
I saw none of those articles.
Well, that was a big article. It caused a storm over here. The first article, both of them in the Washington Post, hats off to them. The first article
was it Colm Lynch's.
That's correct.
Scoop?
The first article wasn't his byline, but one can assume, in fact, correctly, that he was in this issue of the son-in-law of the Secretary General. And I like in this case, I'm able to do it because you could say it's not that I'm going crazy over it. The Washington Post is going crazy about it.
Okay.
In the first instance, the question arose of like, why is the family member of the Secretary General getting this high post in Iraq? And I know for a fact, and it's
he doesn't like his son-in-law.
Say again?
So he probably doesn't like his son-in-law.
I know. No, there's a lot to be said. In fact, the analysis is actually it's very cynical. It's that the new UN.
Sorry, go on. Yeah.
No, the new UN envoy to Iraq is this guy called Stéphane de Mistura, who's a longtime UN player. That in fact this was not Mr. Ban saying to him, please hire my son-in-law. It was this guy saying, I'm going to get in good with Mr. Ban. Let me hire the son-in-law. And the real insiders here said Mr. Mistura did the same thing, hiring the son of Iqbal Riza, which is a long is a name from the oil for food days.
He was a long-standing Kofi Annan.
That is correct. That's correct.
Who took the fall at the end?
He did take the fall, although people did see massive shredding. I just want to say that there was whether the shredding is not always illegal. Yeah. People buy shredders for their own.
So sort of speaking about sort of UN and Iraq, I don't know if you saw this, but James Traub, who is a New York Times reporter.
Sure. A biographer of Kofi Annan, right?
I'm sorry?
A biographer of Kofi Annan.
Yeah, a biographer of Kofi Annan wrote a pretty smart analysis of the UN in Iraq, which appeared on the website of the Stanley Foundation. Mm-hmm. He wrote a report for the Stanley Foundation. And essentially what Trav is arguing is that sort of geopolitical forces are aligning in such a way that the U.S. is and the U.N., the U.S. is going to be essentially forced to turn over the U.N., the Iraq, to the United Nations. Mm-hmm. So he predicts that there's going to be a large U.N. mission, political mission in Iraq.
Sure.
And essentially, you know, because the U.S. has sort of its options are up at this point to forge a diplomatic settlement. The U.N., because it's the only body perceived as being a neutral player among the factions within Iraq, as well as a neutral platform for which Iraq's neighbors can come mm-hmm. together. And sort of promote and support some sort of political settlement in Iraq. That sort of it's almost inevitable in a sense that the UN is going to be playing a much more central role in the political future of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem here, of course, is that the success here is not foreordained. Far from it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more working against peace and reconciliation in Iraq than there is working for it. And also, it remains to be seen the degree to which the United States is willing to give up power and authority to the UN in Iraq.
Right.
Say, for example, if the UN came up with a political solution that involved some sort of oil sharing law unfavorable to the Kurds in Kirkuk,
mm-hmm.
Would the U.S. go along with something like that in the mm-hmm. interests for Iraqi stability? It remains to be seen.
Sure.
And so I wonder, sort of within the UN, if you see almost trepidation
Oh, totally.
The UN assuming a greater role.
I think most people see it as sort of like I mean, I can well, I'll sort of, there's obviously different kinds of people. The staff union is on record saying it's not safe, don't go. But beyond just the sort of self-preservation method of that, I think that there are a lot of kind of well-meaning people that I know see it as kind of craven that the U.S. For the UN to say, oh yes, any role you want to give us in Iraq, we'd like to do it. In the sense that, in these people's perception, people who are skeptical of the U.S.'s invasion, initial invasion, of which there are now many in the United States, but even here in UN land, it's a pretty skepticism of that is widespread. People see the U.S. thumbed its nose at the UN, invaded. Mm-hmm. It's now going badly, and they want to pass off this problem back to the UN. I mean, that's a wide shared perception, and I think some people almost wonder on a more conspiratorial basis whether this handoff wasn't something that may have been discussed between the Bush administration and Ban Ki-moon prior to him being...
I can't speak to these conspiracies, but it seems that the UN is going to be saddled with this problem one way or another. I mean, right now, the UN is taking care of some 2 million refugees. Yeah. That are fleeing Iraq, that live in Syria and in Jordan, and the hundreds of thousands of IDPs within Iraq are, the UN's concern and the UN's responsibility. Mm-hmm. And the UN as a whole is going to have to do, they're going to be saddled with Iraq whether or not the U.S. Mm-hmm. gives it to them or not in one way or the other. So it seems to me that, it's a responsibility that, although not ideal, is something that they might have to take up because they're simply, and this is the point that Jim Traub makes, that there's simply no other option.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
But it can be done, but here's the thing. It can be done, for example, I'll cite this to the Washington Post.
Yeah.
There was an analysis a couple of weeks ago that the UN, this was during debates in Congress about Iraq, that the UN, at the U.S.'s request, delayed the release of a human rights report about Iraq, which when it finally was released was quite scathing. But that there is some coordination between, I guess here's the difference. It may be that the UN, as the organization that it is, just what you're saying, inevitably these problems, and I don't think it's that the UN, like, it's going to have to spend money one way or another. Its job, mm-hmm. its mandate is to deal with problems. So even if the way the problem came about was unfortunate, even if that the actual invasion undermined the UN would still have to step in. But the UN can step in a way that sort of makes its independence from U.S. Interests clear. Like, I go back to Kofi Annan. Kofi Annan said the invasion was illegal, right? He said it. And if you could imagine, had there been a third term, and I'm not a defender of Kofi Annan, but on this one I'll say, I think the U.S. perceived him as something of another pole, as a critic. In the final stages they didn't like it, right? Because here was a guy that could get on CNN at will and say the U.S. is doing the wrong thing. This is something Ban Ki-moon, we have not seen it. We're not one. He couldn't get on CNN. I don't mean to be negative, but I've heard from the horse's mouth it's just not happening. And two, there is no criticism anymore from the UN at the highest levels of what the U.S.
does. Look what happened to Kofi Annan after he said that. Right. So the war supporter hordes were unleashed on him. You know, that's when they unleashed this oil for food witch hunt.
Right.
You know, this is which were
I think there was corruption, though.
Words.
I think there's an. I mean, right.
Yeah. No. I mean, it was a direct result of Kofi Annan saying and thinking that it was imprudent and unwise for the United States to launch an occupation and invasion of Iraq in 2003, and as a result, he got his butt handed to him by these neocon pundits from William Safire to Claudia Rosette to Dan Baevsky, who just who laid into him on that and created a sort of mountain out of a molehill of the oil for food scandal.
I don't know.
In an alternate universe, we would know the oil for food scandal as a program, or the oil for food program as something that kept Iraqis alive and increased their daily caloric intake and brought them medicine and kept weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how we would know it, if not for the fact that this concerted group of obsessives went after him.
I guess I'd say I don't ascribe all the that either the coverage of corruption and misdeeds at the UN, all of it is not a revenge for having opposed the U.S. war in Iraq. I think Kofi Annan thinks it that way. I heard when he spoke when he left, but I think looking at it that way is one of the things that allows continued irregularities and sort of slackness in the UN systems, because there's always a kind of a political, if the motives of those raising it are bad, then we've done nothing wrong. But sometimes things need to be cleaned up.
I think the Volcker Commission, Volcker Report made clear is that, things were done wrong.
Yeah.
But the scope and the scale.
No, sure. I think separately
it was nothing what our perception is. One guy in the UN system who kept $200,000 for himself and has now been indicted and is living abroad somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think in Cyprus. Most of the smuggling and most of the fraud, as it were, was what the Security Council was very aware of.
Sure.
And was just done under their noses, in front of their faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a consequence of the Security Council's inability to do anything about it.
Oh, sure. I think.
And now it's we know it as Kofi Annan's great personal failure.
Right. I think here's where we differ. I think you're right I think it was a big problem, but I think that the way it was spun was that it was entirely Kofi Annan, the Secretariat's problem. I think you're absolutely, there's not enough focus on the way in which the major countries were themselves allowing
right.
it, benefiting from it through their own,
Yeah.
So I think,
right.
I think that, that's, it, that right. I totally agree on.
And I'm saying it's spun that way
right.
because of
right.
Annan's outspoken.
But that doesn't mean, I think there are people that go further and say, there was nothing wrong, it's all, everything is fine here. And I don't find that to be true, frankly. But I think it's important to lay blame often it's countries themselves that allow it for their own reasons,
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're dead on. We can
so maybe another issue.
Okay, yeah, I think we're
recently we had the Security Council elections.
Sure.
Was it the last week?
Yep.
Which selected, I should say, Libya.
Mm-hmm.
To be on the Security Council. How is that received up in Turtle Bay?
No, pretty. I mean, as you probably know, everyone was like, "Is the U.S. going to oppose it?" But I mean, Libya has mm-hmm. rehabilitated its reputation, including in Europe with the U.S. And they were part of the Axis of Evil. And then check it out,
No longer.
They paid some settlements.
And
there were some Lockerbie survivors, families of the victims
right,
that were here.
Understandably.
They were understandably quite concerned about it. But
this, I think, still, you have this obsession by sort of the UN haters who try to tarnish
mm-hmm.
now the Security Council because it has Libya as its member,
right?
And now this is like a reflection of
no, but I think
everything
most
that's wrong with the UN. But in fact, right. I think what it shows is that countries can be brought in from the cold.
Right.
I think it shows that if you are enough if you correct your behavior enough, there are consequences to correcting your. There are benefits, I guess, to correcting your behavior. And we're not only interested in changing your regime, but what we're more interested in is changing how you behave.
Oh, sure.
Just to bring this back to Darfur,
Definitely.
I think it's fair to say that Libya has actually been playing a constructive role
mm-hmm.
in Darfur. Libya is the site of and the host of the peace talks
yep.
set to begin tomorrow.
Yep.
Have been able to the extent that they've been able to. They have some influence over some of the rebel groups,
mm-hmm.
and they're interested in being a more positive regional actor.
They've done it in Chad as well.
Yeah.
They convened the rebels and the government of Chad. They've positioned themselves as something of a kind of a peacemaker or power broker in that whole region.
Yeah.
They're also on
yeah.
record saying there should be a single African state, right? I mean,
yeah.
know that they in the AU. I mean, they have a foreign policy
yeah.
that's extreme, Afrocentric and
yeah.
and it gives them a lot of credibility. No, for what it's worth, it didn't even cross my mind to be like, oh, how could, it's the UN's fault if Libya's on the Security Council.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of different kinds of countries on the world. And this,
yeah.
On this, particularly the yeah. GA, the Security Council, they're supposed to represent, it's not
Correct.
A moral, it's not a moral club, including of the
yeah.
of the P5, I mean, they have
even if you look at sort of the outcomes, like, so Libya is essentially replacing Qatar.
Mm-hmm.
on the council. And, Qatar was not among the most sort of America-friendly member of the Security Council. not, you know, and it was, you know, disruptive to a certain extent.
Not
I don't
much,
think
not
that
much.
Libya. Well, there was a resolution they sponsored, mm-hmm. you know, just your standard anti-Israel resolution right. the U.S. had to veto.
Mm-hmm.
And Qatar usually generally votes against
which
Arab states.
Are you referring back
from Darfur?
Back on the war with Lebanon? I don't know if it was standard. Like every other country in the world voted for it except the U.S.
Well, it was sort of sponsored by Qatar in the Security Council, was it not?
Right, but it was 14-1.
I could be wrong.
It was 14-1. It wasn't.
Okay.
I mean, I think on that right. one, I have to say it's the U.S. that sort of stood out. Like a
I stand.
No.
I stand
but you are. I mean,
are,
I think what's sad is that it's almost sad how little power the non-permanent members of the Security Council
right.
have. I mean, there was all the hoopla a year ago about whether Venezuela would get on. And I guess if they had gotten on, there would have just been a lot more 14-1 votes than speechifying. But literally,
I think the you know problem of Venezuela is more than sort of its single vote. It's you know the fact that you know I think one imagines Chavez would use it as a podium, as a platform, and it would be you know help to discredit the entire Security Council if he got up there and started fulminating like he did at the General Assembly.
Maybe it's a style issue. No, but I think I mean the permanent five, they use their seats like masters. You know, I mean I think that and I think that there is a lot of, to tell you the truth, whatever you think of Chavez, there is a lot of resentment. All of it, I mean, even you could say Japan, India, the countries that don't have the power of these five resent it.
Yeah.
And so it would be. I mean, one thing, and this is not specific to any to a particular conflict, but just in speaking with the diplomats and press people of the non-permanent members of the Security Council, right? The 10 countries that come on for 2 years and get off. I've been shocked at just how frustrated they are with, I mean, down to the level of, this may be under the radar of some people's radar, but Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, it came before the Security Council this week, whether sanctions would be continued on certain people there. The president of Cote d'Ivoire has said the sanctions should be ended and had his representative at the Security Council say, why is France the one drafting all the resolutions about our country when they used to be the colonial master? And they said, why aren't the three African members on the council involved in some way? And there was no answer to that. I ended up standing outside the Security Council one day asking everyone that came out, like, how is France selected? And who gets to do the initial drafts on different, you know? And the answer that's come back, first, a lot of people said, well, it's not formal. You can't really know. It's all, we just agree. The permanent five decide that. And in fact, one non-permanent one, the relatively obscure conflict they were assigned the task of being the drafter on wasn't even the one that they selected. It was just the important ones are taken by the permanent five, and the other ones are doled out at random, almost as make work.
So maybe sort of one final topic. You can
go ahead.
Tell me sort of what would this extrajudicial killing panel that you just attended was all about.
Oh, okay, great. No. What it is that this week and going into next week, these are from the Human Rights Council. They're appointed by the Human Rights Council in Geneva, but they report to this committee of the third committee that handles human rights issues as well. The UN has these special rapporteurs, right? They're independent human rights experts. There's a variety. These are like the thematic ones, right? So so it wasn't a panel. It was the UN's special rapporteur on extrajudicial and arbitrary killings is a law professor called Philip Alston. And
where's he from?
Say again? He teaches at NYU. He's like a big, he's written like textbooks of law. Expert in international law, but he came and spoke. And there was another guy called John Ziegler. He's the one on the right to food. We've had the guy from the right to mental health for everyone. And these, so they come and do press briefings. Alston's was particularly interesting because he's of the rapporteurs. He's one of the more he's aggressive, but very very well very very kind of well spoken. So what he explained is that he's made inquiries with various governments for when things happen. He'll say one of the reporters asked, have you looked into Guantanamo Bay?
Yeah.
And he said he has an interest because there have reportedly been unreported deaths of prisoners, but that the UN system as a whole had tried to send five experts, of which he wasn't one of the five. I spoke to one of the other ones, to Guantanamo to make a fact finding mission, as they do with countries all over the world, right?
Yeah.
And the U.S. said they would only accept three of the five. Two of them, they said, we don't trust your objectivity. You can't come. Yeah. By the way, this is exactly what Sudan did with a mission, right? Yeah. The one with Jody Williams and all that. They started picking and choosing who could come. But the U.S. did this with Guantanamo Bay, and they said the three that could go, but they couldn't speak to any detainees.
Right.
So then the U.N. didn't go.
When was this?
This was in the beginning of 2006.
I recall.
Yeah.
Okay.
The U.N. decided, you know, probably to its credit, that they wouldn't go on a kind of a dog and pony show. Although the U.S.'s defense was that this is what members of Congress get. If it's not good enough for the U.N., too bad, you know?
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is that, obviously, if Sudan or Myanmar does this, the U.S. is the first one to say, you know,
absolutely,
let our people
right.
in. So it's very interesting. But this
right.
guy...
I mean, I think it's an argument for why we ought to be more transparent.
Oh, I agree. I think, just so you know, I'm all... There was a more recent one where the expert on, I guess it's jails and treatments of immigrants, had wanted to visit, you know, the U.S., the sort of privatized detention facilities for undocumented immigrants who are locked up.
Okay.
And the U.S.
Okay.
blocked that thing. But so Alston's whole this one thing that was very interesting that he said is that he'd said that he doesn't choose to get involved in killings that are where a government itself is doing a credible investigation. You know, he thinks that would be a waste of time. So his thing
right.
is, you know, he's written letters to Zimbabwe. He didn't really much like the response mm-hmm. that he got. But he unbeknownst, at least he's actually made an inquiry with the UN system, and it had to do with the peacekeeping mission in Haiti. And and at the time, you know, now things are more peaceful there, but when they were, you know, rolling into Cité Soleil and having shootouts.
In February of this year.
Yeah, and having shootouts with gangs in which civilians would be killed, he made an inquiry. And here was, to my, and this is a highly respected guy. He's very pro-UN, just so, you know, clearly. He works for the UN.
Yeah.
But when asked whether the UN, whether he thought, In his analysis of whether, you know, countries having a credible investigation procedure, whether mm-hmm. he thought the UN's ability to discipline its own peacekeepers, whether in Kosovo where like protesters were killed with 13-year-old rubber bullets that were so hard they were like bullets, or in the Congo where there have been these allegations of torture and executions, whether mm-hmm. since in those cases all the UN does or can do is to send the peacekeeper back to his home country.
Right.
Whether he thinks that's a credible investigation procedure, and he said, I don't think that it is, and that it's mm-hmm. something that he intends to pursue. Whether he
propose like an alternative? Because we've spoken about this before.
I know
the
have.
Difficulty is that, you know, the UN is not a judicial body. You know, the UN has no sort of jail that they could put a mm-hmm. a peacekeeper gone awry. You know, peacekeepers are nationals of their home. You know, when peacekeepers are accused of misconduct, they're sent back to their home country for prosecution, or you know, it's up to the home country actually to prosecute.
That's the whole problem. But I think
that's the problem. You know, it's that the UN, you know, doesn't have the ability to. It's, you know, they're not prosecutors or lawyers. You know,
the problem then is that you have this black hole of the law where they are the ones responsible for sending these guys in with guns, and if something goes wrong, there's no accountability. So nothing else. If nothing else, this guy highlighted that's not acceptable under human rights law, which I just find it interesting.
Yeah.
Again, it's not to say that everything sucks. It's just to say, like, there's a problem there and that the UN's own expert acknowledges
it. I think it's seemingly not, I don't want to say intractable, but it's a very difficult problem to solve.
I think
because, you know, we have, you know, can you imagine, for example, mm-hmm. an American, there are no American peacekeepers,
really,
but if there were an American peacekeeper,
right.
and that American peacekeeper was accused of doing something wrong, mm-hmm. and was then put before a UN judge, the American people would not stand for that. Mm-hmm. Neither, I think, would, you know, the Pakistani people or Nepali people.
But I think what you can say is, as a condition,
such a thing, and that's,
right.
yeah.
As a condition, I don't think that there's as a condition of, because they get paid. I mean, again, this is not a voluntary donation of troops. They're getting paid. Many militaries around the world, in fact, make money off the program. It seems fair to say you must, there is a bare minimum. There's some, maybe every allegation of wrongdoing you're not going to prosecute, right?
Right.
But this case of Rome, it's not just you mm-hmm. know, South Asian countries. The thing in Kosovo to me is like it's two people were killed, right? It involves Romanian peacekeepers in Kosovo. They fired into a crowd, and by somebody's essentially criminal negligence, the ordinance used was so far out of date that that's why it killed people. Nobody disputes that's why it's happened. The UN's admitted it. Nothing has happened, either to the two people that fired, and maybe it's not their fault, to the people that fraudulently put the ammo in. Absolutely nothing has happened.
Well, you know, so the UN operates under this, like, wet lease idea where, you know, you have, for example, if they're Romanian peacekeepers, mm-hmm. I assume that their ordnance came from Romanian stockpiles.
That's right.
And, you know, how does the UN, is it up to the UN to sanction Romania?
I think you need to have an agreement with troop contributing countries in some instance, you have to at least put them on trial. You have to do something. Otherwise, it's a joke.
But the Romanian government has to put the Romanian, you know, officer or whomever.
You may think that I'm criticizing the U.S.
They put U.S.
people. It has a military system of justice, right? They try to put people on trial.
Right. Like I think you're making very, you know, sane and you know, oh. very lucid. Very, you know, you're making good points.
All right.
It just seems that there's very there's a lot of sort of layers of political complications above, you know, the pursuit of justice, which is tragic, obviously, for the people involved in these cases, mm-hmm. But which, you know, again, just speaks to the complexity.
Right. No.
Of the issue, I think you're absolutely correct.
Right.
Though.
But I think, I mean, as an overall principle, and even though, I mean, there are reasons, and there, it's, you know, some of the fixes are going to be complicated. But whenever you either have like a lot of money to spend without really any legal accountability if something goes wrong, or in the case of not peacekeeping, not that anyone necessarily goes in with a bad motive, but where people are given guns.
Right.
There has to be a system of accountability. And it's not that the UN is out of control. It does a lot of good. But there are ways, maybe simply because it's an international organization with full immunity or because it doesn't have its own army. There's a lot of reasons. But the result is, I think, a result is, in some cases, that you have, you know, guns without accountability. And the answer is not to say that it shouldn't exist. It's to say those mm-hmm. things need to be fixed because some of the problems are recurring. And I think they recur because there is not ramifications.
Well, and one imagines if sort of the UN took a harder line, I guess, or if there were circumstances under which the UN or the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations could, you know, single out a company of soldiers and contain them to one, you know, base at a time, which they have in Cote d'Ivoire when the allegations raised.
They got the wrong guy, by the way. But that's another story. The ones that they confined had just rotated into the country, so all of the allegations they have are against other individuals.
And just imagine that troop contributing countries would be less willing to contribute troops if they thought that their troops would be put under the, you know, legal jurisdiction of a foreign body.
Right, but it's, I mean,
and that sort of seems to be a like the hurdle we have to get beyond. Right. In order to solve this,
I think
issue.
There's a way. There's, you know, not, and I'm not saying just only countries that need the money would do it, but I mean that would. Mm-hmm. I just say by that logic, you'd say like no one would want to be a police officer if they knew they could be put on trial if they killed somebody, but they can. You cannot be holding a gun without the ability to be put on trial, right? It just doesn't.
Right.
I mean, look at these Blackwater guys. So
right.
it's just. I think the first step is to acknowledge. I think even, like in the case of Blackwater, even the Bush administration now acknowledges the legal lack of accountability caused this problem. And I think you have – again, it's just – it's.
I just want to make the point, though, that these incidents that you talk of, mm-hmm. They shouldn't be sort of indictments of peacekeeping.
Oh, sure. No, I agree.
And there's obviously room for improvement.
Yep.
At the same time, you know, there are something like 180,000 peacekeepers deployed around the globe.
Sure.
In places like Haiti, like Liberia, like, you know, East Timor. And if there were not peacekeepers there – you know, for example, in Haiti, we'd have, you know, have to have Marines there. Marines, frankly, we don't have at the moment.
No, definitely.
They do, you know, they are, at least from an American foreign policy point of view, you know, very useful.
It's cheaper and, right?
Yeah, it's cheaper and they have a record of mm-hmm. success that they can look back on mm-hmm. and say, look, we've built up East Timor as its own country. Mm-hmm. Or we're in the process of building up Liberia or Sierra Leone. Countries, you know, that 10 years ago were beset by mm-hmm. unimaginable brutality. Mm-hmm. In civil war, and so while there are, you know, certainly room for improvement, you know, we should not sort of let this, you know, condemn peacekeeping.
But nor should we allow the sort of like, you know, you know, laudatory goals, and sometimes yeah. success of these things mean that nothing needs to be fixed.
Right, right. There's always room for improvement.
Not just generalized room. There are particular yeah. problems that cry out for a solution that they don't receive because some people just say, like, oh, if it's being raised, it must be for bad motives, or, but look at our great intentions. It's like the intentions are great. Nobody's disputing mm-hmm. it. You know what I mean?
All right. Good.
All right.
So we've been going for an hour.
Cool. No, I'm sorry. It's been too long. That's
no,
the thing.
No, it's great. I know. I enjoy this. We gotta.
I know
this
it is a little. I mean, I'm open to it. There's a criticism of it that it could be not too freewheeling. It's sort of. I feel like an underlying theme is kind of like clearly you're like you jump to the defense, and so this makes me more like on the attack. But it's not.
No, I think we see eye to eye on most things.
Right.
Actually.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I think it. Provides for like useful back and forth.
All right.
Because I think you also give a very good sort of inside the right. bowels of the UN perspective.
Too far inside, I'm sure. But that's
well,
why
no,
it's good that
it's,
you've got.
It's useful
you're the
for
big
me,
picture
you know,
guy.
I'm,
you know?
I'm in D.C., so it, you know, it, it, you know, I think we balance each other out.
All right.
And I enjoy talking to you.
Well,
that's what matters for me. Screw these blogging heads viewers.
Absolutely. I don't feel it's my place to say that. You know that.
No. I enjoy this very
cool.
much.